Thank you, Arlene, and thank you for coming today. I'm going to thank the Millennium Library, and actually the Winnipeg Public Library, because it's so wonderful to partner with them. I also want to, before I introduce Sonia, to thank our volunteers. The festival cannot run without our volunteers, and we've got a couple working here and a couple sitting in the audience. And I also want to mention our volunteer who worked with Big Ideas for years and years, who passed away a few months ago, Darlene McCullough. So she was our regular Big Ideas person, and I'm missing her. I think we're missing her. Anyway, Sonia Boone, oh, you're going to have a good time today. This is such a moving, beautiful book. It really is. Sonia Boone is associate professor at Memorial University. She's a researcher, a writer, a teacher, and one-time provincial, principal flautist. All these P words, and I come up with the wrong one. One-time principal flautist with Portland Baroque Orchestra. Her book, What the Oceans Remember, is based on extensive archival research and her own complex heritage. And it addresses things like history, belonging, migration, race, and much, much more. Please welcome Sonia Boone.
First of all, thank you so much for coming. Thank you to the festival for the invitation to come here. And I also want to do a shout-out to the press because they created the most beautiful book ever. Like, as a thing, it's a really beautiful thing. And it's so brand new, I only got my copy last week. Like, it's seriously brand new. So today I want to talk a bit, I guess, about the big ideas that shape this book and also to share some images of some of the things, places I saw, some of the materials I looked at, and also should read some excerpts from the book itself. And this will be a sort of an interspersed sort of activity. So basically, the big idea is in the subtitle both of the book, really, and it's listed right there, belonging and home. What does it mean to belong? What does home mean? And how do we understand them in the context of long histories of colonialism? And this is probably, as I was preparing for this, I was looking through some stuff that had happened in St. John's and in Newfoundland over the summer. And one thing that happened was the Bonavista Biennale, and one of the artists there presenting was a performance artist, Camille Turner, and she hosts the Afronautic Research Lab, which seeks to uncover histories of colonial complicity in the transatlantic, colonial Canadian complicity in the transatlantic slave trade. And its most recent iteration, she came to Newfoundland and she shared archival documents about Newfoundland's, I guess, connections, economic connections, the transatlantic slave trade. And a lot of people knew about, for example, the shipping of poor quality salt fish to feed the enslaved. But a lot of other people did not know about the fact that 19 slave ships were made in Newfoundland. And she said, when she was interviewed by CBC, this is what she said, we didn't create this history. None of us did. We weren't here, but it's what shaped us. By not dealing with it, we can never move on from here. We can't really move into a future where things are equitable. So I think it's really important to acknowledge these stories. And I think she articulates really well the conundrum in which we find ourselves, because all of us are inheritors of terrible histories, of brutal histories, of violent histories, histories of dehumanization, histories of genocide. But somehow we need to make sense of them. We need to figure out how to work with them, live with them, and we need to figure out what the afterlives of these stories are. What are the afterlives of colonialism, slavery, indenture, and residential schools? And what does that mean in the present day? And so if I take my questions of what is belonging, what is home, and I look and I revise them slightly, then I might say, what does it mean to belong in the afterlives of slavery, indenture, and more? What does home mean in the context of these histories? And in a world shaped by migrations, which is really what I'm looking at, both forced and voluntary migrations, how do we navigate our differences in socially and historically complex sorts of ways? And how do we make sense of troubling histories and complicated mixtures? And I want to share a couple pictures that are part of that. I'm going to try this one more time, see what happens. So this is one picture making me think of questions of belonging. This is a sign, a street sign in Suriname, that is between two former plantations. Frederiksdorp on one side was a coffee plantation, became a police outpost, and is now a resort, which is also a bit of a brain twist. And the other is a Johan Margrethe, which is a small village at this point. So this is a sign. Creole and Vech is the Creole street, and then the street to Frederiksdorp. So it makes me think about belonging. The next picture. This is my great-grandmother Oma Duffy's house, which I was not able to see in person. And what you'll see here is my great-grandmother. She's my great-grandmother herself with her grandchildren. This is my mom. Do not tweet that. She'll be horrified. If anybody's tweeting. But you can see there a whole range of mixtures happening there. So what does home mean? Here, one of the archival materials I looked at, an immigration prospectus for an immigration society. So after slavery ended, plantation owners said, well, what do? We don't have free, quote-unquote, free labor anymore. We want cheap labor. And so they came up with a plan originally to bring in indentured laborers, so people who would come in for a fixed year, five-year contract, to work at plantations in Suriname. And this was for ones that would come from China originally. And here, thinking about sort of troubling histories, this is all that remains of one plantation, of Bent's Hope Plantation, owned by John Bent in the 1820s, 1830s. And he had a really fancy sort of steam-powered sugar processing equipment, and that's all you can see of it. And that's all that remains is really the forest, the jungle has really taken over at this point. So my question is, how do we live in the afterlives of all of this? And they're big questions, they're hard questions, and they're prickly, because the truths they might reveal might be very uncomfortable to us. But that's what I was trying to work my way through in this particular book. And as someone who works with archival materials, and I'll talk a little bit more about archival materials in a bit, I know, as Camille Turner does, that our pasts will continue to determine our presence. And so I decided to look at this looking at my own family history. Here's me, cute four-year-old, in Suriname, visiting my aunt and uncle when I was four. And I became my own case study, and I asked these questions of myself and my own histories, which sounds all super intellectual, which it was at the beginning. My plan was that I was going to do this as a research project, and I would write an academic work that would be somewhat unconventional, but it would still be a wholly recognizably academic sort of work. So memoir was not necessarily on the table the way it's turned out in any case. So the question was why, and I'll talk about that, why that changed as well. So my question is then, why did I choose myself? This is a map that's on the inside of the book, on the front side of the book. Why I chose myself for this, and why I chose myself is, one, I was someone who was born in England, but I have no English heritage whatsoever. Then we moved to Venezuela, then we moved to Canada, where I lived in several provinces. But my parents came from the Netherlands, and my dad came from the Netherlands. My mother came from Suriname, which at that point was a Dutch colony. My mother has no Dutch in her at all. My great-grandfather, on my mother's side, one of my mother's side, comes from India as an indentured laborer. He came. My great-grandmother, the woman you saw in the previous image, or two pivots before, was the child of an enslaved woman, so moves further back to West Africa. So I carried this history and a complex history in my own family past. And what I was thinking through is, how has this history shaped who I understand myself to be, but also how others have understood me to be? And what are my responsibilities to this particular past? How do I live with this past and these histories in the present day? And so where these questions came from was, one, I've always been asked. So as long as I can remember, where are you from? It's been a question that's been asked of me, right? So it's probably been asked to me 700 times over the years. And inevitably, people get it wrong when they try. So that's one thing that's been sort of bubbling around in the background. But it started bubbling higher, if you will, when I moved to Newfoundland, where place is really central to identity. And everyone, seemingly, it's certainly not everyone, but it seems like it, seems to know what home is and what it means to belong. So what I wanted to do is start with an early section of my book, which is a chapter called Tumbling Stones. I called it that because it reminds me of the sounds that the stones make at a place called Middle Cove Beach, which has become very special to us. It's just outside of St. John's. I also have some pictures, so hopefully I can read and move this ahead at the same time. So here's Middle Cove Beach, looking very tropical, which it's not. So I'll read a bit from Tumbling Stones, which gives a sense of where I'm coming from. We discovered Middle Cove Beach within days of our arrival in Newfoundland in 2008. And over the years, this small beach just outside St. John's has become one of my favorite places to hang out. There's nothing much to it, on that even locals would agree. It's just a sheltered inlet between craggy cliffs, one of thousands along the coast of Newfoundland. It's not sandy, but then so few beaches here are. Rather, it's covered in thousands of small beach stones that form hills and valleys according to the ocean's mood. Some are round, others egg-shaped. Some are perfect for skipping across the water. In the summer, the stones are warm, almost alive with the sun's energy. And in the winter, when ice waterfalls cling to the cliff's edge, creating ethereal curtains of bluish-white, the cold bites into your skin, and the stones are best left alone. A few years ago, a storm rushed in, and the ocean took them all away, leaving behind a stark, barren landscape. But months later, the beach stones were back, once again shifting with the tides. Officially, you're not supposed to collect them, but somehow over the years, at least a dozen have found their way into our home. I can't help myself. The beach stones are smooth and soft, sharp edges worn away by their constant tumbling in the ocean's waves. At home, they lie cool and heavy, each a comfortable weight in the palm of my hand. One has a thick quartz vein running right across it, and another, round like a perfect pumpernickel loaf, is purple, tiny bands of gray circling its balanced shape. When they are wet, each one is a jewel, glowing rich and warm. But when dry, they almost fade into one another. Indistinct, their meaning is collective rather than singular. As a group, these stones hold the rhythms of the sea, and together they make water music, a serenade of waves rising and crashing against the shore, and then, as if in response, a clattering rush of stones spilling over each other at the water's edge. As they bump and roll against one another, they tell each other's stories too, shaping and polishing that smoothness that I cup in my hands every summer. And at home. In them is the story of this place called Newfoundland. In them too, I have discovered, is the story of my family, a collection of tumbling stones worn smooth by oceanic migrations, each one a fragment, together an always moving landscape of histories, memories, longings, and dreams. I have no roots here. There is nothing that binds me to this windy rock in the North Atlantic, no family history that clings to the cliffs or washes up from the seas. But it's here, among the polished stones of Middle Cove Beach, that I first began to grapple with origin. Here that I started thinking about the meaning of home. Here that I began to work through my desires for belonging. Home is important to Newfoundlanders. Place is central to their identity. Many can pull their family histories across this island, tracing stories that go back centuries. They can picture the salt box houses where their grandparents lived. They can walk the paths of their ancestors. They know the voices of those who have come before them. As a people, they're one with the island, deeply rooted in this place, profoundly shaped by weather, landscape, and the volatile moods of the sea. "Where are you from?" they would ask during my first year here, and I would struggle to answer. "Most recently from Vancouver," I eventually said, and it was true. "You must have married a Newfoundlander," they said, confidently, because they couldn't really imagine any other reason why I would be there. But it wasn't true. I'm a mainlander, a come-from-away, someone who doesn't quite fit and whose roots haven't dug themselves into this soil or crawled along these rocks. Come-from-away. It's a phrase that used to frustrate me. It made me angry. A come-from-away will never belong, will never fit in, this phrase suggests. Mainlanders aren't like us, it whispers. More than this, a come-from-away is an interloper, someone who doesn't really have the right to be there. The boundaries were drawn well before we arrived, and none of us had a say in where we were placed. "No," I shoot back, "I'm an NBC, Newfoundlander by choice." But that term isn't quite right either. I'd always thought that home was wherever I happened to be at any given time. I thought that community was something people built together, regardless of their origins. But maybe there's more to it. Living in Newfoundland, with the ocean lapping at my toes, has brought all of this into high relief. I've spent much of my life on the outside looking in. I've never lived in a place I could fully call home. I'm rootless, myself spreading across three continents, my history spanning five. Belonging is fragile, fragmented, and multiple. Home is impossible. I'm an outsider within, a chameleon who can take on the guise of the local, but who will never be fully recognized as one, and perhaps more to the point, will never truly feel like one. But here at Middle Cove Beach, where the Capelin come to play, I wonder. Middle Cove Beach is where my children learned how to skip rocks. It's where they sailed the wooden boat that their great-grandfather built some 40 years ago for their father. It's where they've fallen shivering into icy water and where they've stood laughing, watching as their dad poured a cold salt waterfall out of his boots. Middle Cove Beach is where they almost got caught behind a rogue wave, where they've clambered around like mountain goats, moving higher and higher along the slate cliff ledges. It's where we've watched winter storms, awed by the power of the heaving ocean. And where we touched our first capelin. Middle Cove Beach has taught us about weather and about water. It's taught us about fish and community. It's taught us about Newfoundland, the place and its peoples. It's shown us, too, the possibilities and the limits of belonging. Like the water-worn stones, beach stones that tumble along these shores, boundaries have softened in the years since we arrived. And I've learned some local ways, and silently, without any words at all, bonds of tenuous trust have formed. Boone, people will sometimes ask. The Boones from Name Your Outport Community? I shake my head, no, not those Boones. At heart, I'm still a mainlander, and things divide along those ways here. Mainlanders hang with mainlanders, or if they're lucky, with Newfoundlanders who've spent so much time on the mainland that they've almost lost their own claims to belonging. Where are you from? I thought I knew. So my response to trying to answer the question, where are you from, where do you belong, was logically, as someone who's worked in the archives, to see what stories the archives would reveal to me, where they would take me. And I think that's probably the second most important part of this book, is really it's a book about the stories that archives can tell and stories that they can't tell. And I guess in that way, it's a love letter to archives and archival research. That's a picture of some maps that I was looking at the Royal Archive, the National Archives in The Hague. So I've worked in archives for years, and I don't know if anybody's worked in archives here, but I've developed over time ways of working. So for example, where some people use computers and stuff like that, I never use computers. I like working by hand with my Moleskine notebook. I write on the right-hand side of the page with pencil in the archives, and in the evening, I use markers and a pen on the left-hand side so I can see them together. I've also developed these sort of bizarre behavioral rituals when I'm in the archives. So for example, if I go away, I often don't have much time to work at the archives, so I'm not there for 3 months, although I would love to be. I usually have like 2 weeks. And so I even do things like controlling bodily functions, which sounds like too much information, but I'll tell you this. So what I do, for example, is like if I was in Switzerland, I had 10 days to work at the archives over a 2.5 week period because it was closed on Saturdays and Sundays and on Monday mornings. The archives were open from 10 till 5, which basically meant 4:45 because you had to clean up then. So I would get up at like 6, I would drink water until 8, then I would not drink anymore, I would pee at 9:59, and then I would work all day until 4:45, at which point I would take my exhausted and desperate to pee self to the bathroom, go to the bathroom, eat my sandwich, and walk along the lake, and then do work again. Like anybody who's worked in archives may recognize some of these kinds of ritualistic behaviors. It's very bizarre, the kinds of things we do to try and make the most of our time. Now, I had developed this over time, and most of the material I'd been working with was what I would call juicy stuff, right? Yummy, rich, detailed, gossipy things like letters and diaries. And in letters and diaries, you get humor, you get pathos, you get whinging, you get anger, you get frustration, love. You get the documents run the gamut of human emotion. So they're filled with stuff that you can, I guess, hang your hat on. And the routines that I had developed worked really well. But I soon discovered that it's different when you're working with materials that aren't so immediately seductive. And let me tell you that government documents are not so immediately seductive. When there are no juicy letters, and in fact, when the people you're researching have not been the authors of any juicy letters. And further, when the people whose story you're looking for exists only either in A, lists meant to compensate their owners, and let's just think about that for a bit, compensate and owners, or later ship's logs that were interested only in securing and identifying their indentured human cargo. This, for example, is one big file of accounting declarations. So in 1862, when slavery was going to be abolished, the plantation owners were clamoring away because they said we need to be compensated for the fact that we are, quote-unquote, losing our labor, quote-unquote. And the Dutch government said, sure, we'll give you 300 guilders per slave that you have. And so the enumerators went around Suriname counting and listing the enslaved in big lists. So it was very hard to, it was different when we're, and it was also different when reading my own history. So I couldn't keep my distance that I've gotten used to doing. It was hard to keep my archival neutrality on, which is not to say I hadn't been moved by material in the past, because I had, but it's on a whole different level when it's about yourself. And as I write in the book, there was nothing was anonymous and everything was personal. And not only was everything personal, most of it was horrifying, right? So I'm going to show you sort of what you'll see here. This is the backdrop of every slide that almost every slide on this presentation. This is a page from the accounting register for Sarah Plantation, where some of my ancestors were enslaved. And what I've circled there, what I've squared there, rectangled, is an entry for Frederick, 63, who was one of my ancestors in this register. So when I saw these materials, it was relatively early on, and I was still trying to squish this material into my usual archival working practices. But this experience showed me that that wasn't possible. And so what I want to read is about my first encounter with these plantation records. These are materials that I did know existed. I did know about them. because I'd seen some transcriptions of the details relevant to my specific family before, but it also marked a turning point for me in terms of how I chose to approach all the materials I saw after that point and how I thought about them. So this is a section where I talk about going to these archival materials. And at first, the plantation was called Sarah, and I was, theoretically, they're all alphabetical within the files, but Sarah was not. And so that's where I start. There it was, Sarah, at the bottom of the pile after Susanna's doll. Immediately I retreated, my professional research shell sliding firmly in place. Like the enumerators, I cataloged and organized. I counted pages and laid them out for careful photography. I remained impartial, and in my research journal I wrote, "The list includes a total of 178 men and 146 women. Youngest is 2 months old, photos taken. This is a much larger plantation in terms of numbers of slaves than the other ones I saw today. An awful lot of young people on this plantation, many teenagers and children. The oldest appears to be 77, but there are only two over 70, one man who is 73, Glassford, and one woman, 60. In 60s, there were 10 in their 60s, more men than women, circa 90 between the ages of 10 and 19. That's about 25% of the total, 102 between 0 and 10. Thus, fully half the slaves were below the age of 20, with a large number below 10 even. I saved my document, and then after emailing the photos to my cousin, I turned off my computer and shut the manuscript file. I closed it, I tied the ribbon, put everything back into the box. All around me, a light brown dust from the crumbling edges of 19th century paper. I returned the box to the counter, packed up my computer, straightened out my notes, and headed out the door. Back in my hotel, I logged onto social media and updated my status, as you do. Today, I found part of my family tree, I wrote, attaching a photo I took of the first page of the plantation register. It was only much later that evening, long after a sushi dinner with an old friend from my conservatory days, that I realized that I'd turned myself off. My professional self had silenced my personal self. Finding my family in the archives, in a plantation register, should have been a momentous thing. I should have allowed myself to feel, to savor, reflect, and grieve. But instead, I'd cocooned myself, retreating behind the safety of the research lens. I hadn't taken time to feel the paper. I hadn't really read the names. I hadn't sounded them out in my mind, felt them on my tongue. Like the enumerators, I just sorted and organized, cataloged and counted. And now that moment, that very first encounter with the materiality of my past was lost. I'd never have it back again. The next morning, when I returned to the archives, I ran my fingers down the pages, looking specifically for the names that I knew would be there. Philip, male, 41, Field, Moravian. Edward, male, 43, Field. Frederick, 63, male, old, Moravian. Eva, female, 34, Field, Moravian. Sultan, male, 14, apprentice carpenter, Moravian. Wilson, male, 4, playing. Jani, female, 12, field. In between them, hundreds more. Name, sex, occupation. Coffee, male, 46, field. Cupid, male, 45, field. Augustus, male, 17, Smith. Manchester, male, 62, old. Titus, male, 52, watchman. Peter, male, 13, cattle herder. Mermaid, female, 52, caregiver. Katharina, female, 50, cook for the ill. Delia, female, 51, caregiver for Creole children. Petronella, female, 15, house slave. Page after page after page. This wasn't just my family, this was a whole community. The register transferred itself into a census. Census, an account of a given population in a given place at a given time. The names ran together, tumbling one after another through my consciousness, overwhelming me. Peak, Johnson, Isaac, Riley, Simon, Samuel, John, Abraham, Ned, Sandy, John, Odin, Cruden, Theodore, Augustus, Prince, Charles, Elder, Wilson, Philip, Coffee, Cupid, Slaus, Edward, Franz, Chance, Yaw, Charlie, Sydney, Kit, London, Thomas II, William, Johnny, Pallas, Ajax, Robert, Kwame, Kingsmill, Johannes, Jean-Baptiste, Jack, Slengard, Christoffel, Robertson, James, Ben, Bernhardt, Gaussi, Darby, Marcus, Charles, David, Arthur, Jilby, Jacob, Frolik, Doris, Van Tol, Farwell, Anderson, Jacques, Douglas, Demion, Anthony, Henry, Greenfield, Andrew, Ricketts, Whitecomb, Minosabi, Augustinus, Samuel II, Dirk, Dick, Harris, Sampton, Heinche, Hendrik, Peter, Frederick, Glassford, Manchester, Hercules, Titus, Alfred, Daniel, Steward, Fortuyn, Adrian, Salomon, Cupido, Neuchedacht, Romeo, James, Ryder, Rosin, Casper, Archie, Vicheland, Ferrier, Frederick, Bathol, Ferdinand, Cornelis, Sultan, Bater, Welcome, Christopher, Richard, Elder II, Edward, Toussaint, Blandford, Monroe, Amsterdam, Bethune, Green, Jurgensen, Adam, George II, Second Glassford, Simon II, Nelson, Carlisle, Duncan, Jack II, Primo, James III, Charles II, Thomas II, Lancaster, Samuel III, Francis, Harris II, Peter II, Seymour, Glass, Mars II, Frederick III, Kit II, Isaac II, Joseph, Tom II, Slouch II, Philip II, Camden, Abraham II, Desse, Brunings, Wilson II, Johnson II, Stuart II, Christian, Mentor, Ned, Fortuyn, Alexander, Mandach, Mingo, Harry, Fritz, Edwin, Henry II, George IV, Greenfield II, Cicero II, Jacob II, Bent II, Troby, Lodewijk, Willy, Bonaparte, Ferdinand, Vinst, Tom, Peak II, Leander, Venus, Fanny, Hannah, Caledonia, Clarissa, Sophia II, Sarah, Dolly, Nancy, Flora, Rosina, Susanna, Helen, Margaret, Elizabeth, Sina, Clara, Diana II, Phyllis, Patience, Manche, Sophonosbia, Celestina, Eve, June II, Frederica, Ajuba, Bella, Molly, Madlenche, Kea, Yetta, Koba, Janetta, Dorothea, Sophia, Trouche, Dorche, Lucrecia, Mariana, Jane III, Lissy, Emma, Victoria, Pandoria, Aurora, Constancy, Loche, Johanna, Janche, Rebecca, Daphne, Wilhelmina, Georgina, Miche, Betsy, Gracia, Anche, Minerva, Petronella, Mermaid, Louisa, Sally, Jane II, Delia, Florinda, Lanner, Katharina, Belle, Clarinda, Princess, Lucia, Katharina I, Kitty, Belle, Sarache, Cato, Amba, Maggi, Christiana, Louisa, Julia, Paternella, Eliza, Anche, Esther, Vinette, Eva, Charlotte, Filipina, Jani, Jani III, Janche, Grace, Lydia II, Sarah II, Rosette, Sophia, Johanna II, Clarinda II, Mary II, Asia, Harriet II, Caro, Venus II, Martina, Betty II, Princess II, Katharina III, Mermaid II, Elisa, Fidela, Cecilia, Cecilia III, Caledonia II, Fanny II, Venus III, Carolina, Peggy III, Madeleine II, Amelia II, Yosina, Baby, Betsy II, Margaret II, Hannah II, Princess II, Jacquelina, Josefina, Sophia, Florence, Anache, Clarissa II, Senna II, Callista, Hendrina, Helena, Lena, Jeanette II, Francina, Christina, Betty III, Kate, Catrainche, Glazina, Kitty. Once I looked, I couldn't look away. This family history of enslavement was real, and the pain of knowing was acute. And as if pursuing some form of ritual form of self-flagellation, I kept coming back for more that day, returning over and over to the records for Sarah Plantation. There was a rhythm to the names, and typing them out one after another became a meditation. Letters into sounds, into words, into names, into communities. Letters lay under my fingers, names settled on my tongue. Speaking their names brought them into existence, made their lives tangible, material, real. Typing became a way of keeping vigil, bearing witness, honoring the dead. So I looked at a range of archival materials for this particular book. I looked at ship's logs in addition to plantation records. I looked at ship's logs. This is the ship's log for the 1873-74 journey of the Kate Kellogg from Calcutta to Suriname and then back to, from Liverpool to Calcutta to Suriname and then slowly back up to Liverpool, on which two of my ancestors sailed. And there was a mutiny on there, and it was all very interesting. So I looked at those. I also looked at historical newspapers and particularly advertisements. I looked at early photographs, images, paintings. This is a painting of Sarah Plantation in the 1860s. I also looked at family documents and written oral histories. So this project forced me to work very differently with materials and to see differently and to think differently. And it also asked me to write differently. It asked me to think about who I was, not only in relation to the world in which I live, but also in relation to the archival materials and to my histories. And it really demanded my whole body in a way that previous research had not. Not just my intellectual engagement. It asked me to attend more closely, to spend more time, to ask more questions, and to dwell in speculation, because there were so many gaps. And in that, that's when I realized that I couldn't just write a traditional academic thing, even an academic thing with a difference. It wasn't going to work as well as I wanted to. And I needed to move into something much more personal. I needed a different way of storytelling. I had to be something more intimate, more personal, and more questioning. It had to bring histories, memories, migrations, belonging, and home together to somehow make sense of this very complicated family history. And I cannot tell you how long I struggled to try and find a voice and to find a structure that would make sense of this. And the reason this was important to me was because if we go back to Camille Turner's words, this is never just my story, it's all of our story. We come to it in different ways, but we need to acknowledge it and to work through it and take responsibility for it. We weren't there then, but we need to figure out how to live it. And as I write in the book, the project unmoored me completely. I was really undone by what I was reading and really undone by the implications of everything that I was reading. And I want to end with just a very short, this is not my own writing, this is a quote from the Zimbabwean-born writer Panache Shigumadzi, writing about history. And this is the Komavaina River in Suriname. History, and I got to put my glasses on or I can't see it. History, writes the Zimbabwean-born writer Panache Shigumadzi, is like water. It lives between us and comes to us in waves, at times still and unobtrusive, and at other times turbulent and threatening. Even at its most innocuous, water poses hidden dangers, enclosing contested histories, and so we are always living in the tension between water's tranquility and its tumult. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sonia. We'll throw it open for questions, but I just wanted to thank you for reading that list of names, because when I read the book, I found myself having to read them aloud as well, and I had a feeling I just had to pay tribute to these people, and the word slaves doesn't always seem to include the word people.
Yes, and in some ways, in some cases, this is all that remains of them, is these lists, as horrifying as it is, these lists. So the relationship between, I guess, between slavery and indentured servitude. The conditions were slightly different in that it was for a specific time. It was not for life, and nor was it like chattel slavery, which goes through generations. So there has been debate, particularly a lot of what I looked at, because it was a woman who came with her son. Did it offer possibilities for women, indentured servitude? And some scholars think it did provide some, because it allowed women to move out of the traditional caste system in which they were living, and perhaps allow for a different way of living after that point. They did get paid, which some of them may not have been paid before. And they, if they were perhaps in difficult situations back home, say they were widowed, say they were abandoned or whatever, they had a chance to remake themselves. So that is that could be seen as a potential positive of indentured labor, but indentured labor was not easy, and there was also a lot of violence. And again, I'm looking at indentured women laborers, because that was a lot of what my focus was, where they were subject to a lot of violence. While they were able to move their way slowly up a social ranking in some cases, some of those relationships, if they decided to go back to India after their five-year period was finished, because they were promised that they would get free return passage after their five-year period. And some did choose to go back. And if they had broken caste boundaries at that point, sometimes those relationships just ended. They were right back where they were before, right? That said, even though they were promised to go back, it was only if there was a ship available. So some people had to wait 20 years, even if they finished their their thing. So indentured labor is, I think, better than slavery, but neither is a good situation, if that helps. Will people ask the same questions in the when they look back? Will they ask the same questions in the past? I think there are... Every period has a certain zeitgeist, right? So there's certain things that are important at particular periods that perhaps may never be important again, but we're always going to be asking questions of the past. And in many ways, we ask questions of the past because we want to answer questions in the present, right? So 50 years from now, there could be something that is really relevant for people trying to understand the past, and they will look to the past to see what it was that got us to where we're at. So I think people are always going to be asking questions of the past. Whether they're exactly the same questions, I don't know. Does that... Okay. So the question is talking about the process of getting towards a structure, in a sense. Lots of pain. It was a long process trying to find a way to make all of this somehow make sense. And because I was dealing with also two timelines, right? The present day, looking at the past, and then the past timeline, and then materials that are in all sorts of different places. And there's now becoming to be more of that kind of stuff, but a lot of material, certainly from the academic perspective, tries to break it up. Here's histories of Indian indentured laborers, here's histories of slavery, here's histories of Europeans doing this, but not as much that looks at all of that together. So I think a lot of it was experimentation. A lot of it was a lot of free writing, and then cutting and pasting, and then spreading it out across the floor in our house, on the wall in our house, across all the tables in our seminar room, with sticky notes everywhere, cutting and pasting some more, using markers, and really massaging it and massaging it and massaging it until things started to make more sense. So I think structure was really the most fraught aspect of it, and I spent months and months and months and months and months and months. It felt like forever. I'm sure some people would say it wasn't that long at all, but it sure felt like an awfully long time, and that's probably not very helpful at all. But it was really a lot of scissors, markers, and sticky things that were moved around. Sorry, that's not...
Can I ask, because you said when your other archival work, you were looking at juicy things like letters and diaries. Were you expecting anything like that for this work?
You know, I didn't necessarily expect juicy things, right? So I didn't necessarily... I knew that I was going in, that I was going to deal with government documents. But I didn't realize the extent to which working with... How much my archival working practice had been shaped by reading juicy things. Right, and that I would need to, and juicy things about other people, not about my family, and so that I would need to then put on a different uniform, if you will, to work with this kind of material, and that was something that I hadn't expected. All of these, the materials, so what materials did I look at? All the materials that I looked at, so there's a number of places, all of these were public archives, except for the stuff that my own family has, historical photos, that kind of thing, right? But all the rest was public archives, so anybody can really apply and get your picture taken and go in with your clear bag and do your thing. I also used a lot of online archives. So there's an online historical newspaper, Delfer NL. It's all the historical Dutch newspapers and certain of all the colonies and everything. It goes back to like 17 something or other. And it's all digitized. So that you can find, I could find that in my own house. The only archive that is now no longer accessible, that was accessible when I was there, was in the archives of Zeeland. They had the Middelburgse Commerce Company, which was a trade company that was involved in the slave trade in the 18th century. It's a UNESCO sort of memory of the world register series of documents because it's such a complete set of business records from the 17th century into the 19th century. And that material was accessible, actually, to touch the first time I went. Now they have digitized everything, and for the security of the documents, it's only available online, unless I think you give away your first child or something. So that's a really good question. What is the archival capacity of the ocean? And one of the things that struck me, I grew up in Alberta. Ain't no ocean to be found anywhere in Alberta, right? So it was only when I moved to Newfoundland that I really started thinking about oceans and what happens with oceans and how oceans operate. How do people traverse oceans? What do they see? What do they experience? What do they encounter? How does that feel? And so for me, a lot of when I was reading ship's logs and so on, I was reading about things that, for example, when a ship log's entry is only latitude and longitude, and then for me as a landlubber, where is that? I can't even make sense of it. By the same token, in the Middle Bristol Commercy Company records, they would have their ship's logs and it would say, saw 24 flying fish, saw another ship in the distance. And so I had to try and imagine myself being on board one of these ships. What would it be like to see these ships? I understand that slave ships were apparently incredibly smelly ships because they were transporting hundreds of people, and so they were very smelly ships, and you could smell that from a long distance. What would that be like to pass one of those ships, to see what that was like? We also know that people died along oceanic crossings, so the ocean itself carries the bodies of those who have died. It carries the hopes of those who were maybe thinking they were going to a better life when they were in indenture. It carries also all of the sort of horror of where are we for people who were forcibly put onto ships. And all of that is constantly in motion. A book that has not related to this, but that I read more recently by Renissa Mawani called Across Oceans of Law, who looks at the move of the Komagata Maru and its move towards Canada. She talks about oceans as, because there are currents that are operating at different levels, and so she thinks also about the stories and memories that operate at different levels. And I think thinking about currents that way, that there are currents underneath that tell certain things and pull different things, and currents above. So we've got the stories that are in the records about oceans, like the flying fish, the latitude and the longitude. Then we've got the stories that are gone, like the stories of the people who died on their oceanic crossings, the people who were not able to tell their stories. Then we have the horror stories, like the story of the Zong, for people who don't know, was a slave ship in the 18th century that at some point they made a mistake with their calculations. They ran out of water, and in order to deal with running out of water, they tossed 130-some enslaved Africans overboard. And then they claimed them as insurance, as cargo that they lost. So the only thing that exists of that is the court case of that. So those are the ocean stories. There are the stories that are lost in the bottom of the ocean. There are stories in Suriname too. There's a ship that made it to the mouth of the Suriname River, and then the enslaved were locked in the bottom of the hold, and that ship sank. And so those stories are there as well. But then the stories that are in the records. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what I was thinking. And it was hard at the beginning for me as someone who did not have ocean experience directly.
More questions? I think in the Zong, did they got compensation, didn't they? The owners, I think they did get compensated for the slaves. And one more round of applause for Sonia Boone.
Thanks for coming.